Jimmy Rooney and Sunny Day were a double act in the twilight years of variety. This period, as many of my senior listeners will remember, overlapped by a decade or so the slow and painful birth of television. At the time, I was surprised that these two didn't kill off the new medium in its infancy, but I have to admit that the public loved them, and they made a lot of money. You may be surprised, even shocked, to hear that they were also the meanest couple in show business, and they held this title for many years against some fierce competition. Much of their wealth came from their indefatigable work for charity. When they topped the bill at concerts for deserving causes, they commanded record fees. They were much in demand at royal functions and often made cheeky remarks about the monarchy at command performances, sickeningly careful not to overstep the mark and always remembering to touch their forelock or make some verbal avowal of loyalty. In view of all this and a lot more besides, you may wonder why I ever agreed to be their business manager on their first and last tour of Australia. Well, I had my reasons. The winter sunshine beckoned. I was intrigued by the emergent wine industry. My introduction to Hunter Valley Claret had been in the refreshment room of Crewe Station one wet Sunday when I'd shared a bottle with a homesick Australian juggler. It had a garish label, but the wine within had a complex nose and a buttery elegance that lingered on the palate well past Wolverhampton. There was another reason I was ready to try pastures new. A few weeks earlier, my idea for a comedy series about the Home Guard had been turned down by BBC Television. Bad taste, they cried. It would be unthinkable to mock the brave old men who stood ready to defend our island in its darkest hour. Exactly how this immensely popular show came to be televised a couple of years later without my name appearing on the screen would make a fascinating story. Anyway, when the invitation came to have a chat with Rooney and Day and their agent Andy Fertel, I accepted. With anyone else, this would have meant lunch at the Savoy or the Ivy, at the very least at a quality inn. But I was invited to chat to them over a coffee, and to get it I had to grope my way up the staircase of a dingy church property in Soho to a room too small to provide a workplace for the French models who advertised their services below and who occupied the rest of the building. I waited about 20 minutes, sipping instant coffee from a stained plastic mug and chatting to Andy Fertel. He told me several times that everything was very quiet, thus setting me up to accept a derisory salary for what he described as the trip of a lifetime. Rooney and Day arrived together. They were very rarely apart. Nevertheless, they were not what one might call close. Let me explain. Rooney was the one with the overactive salivary glands who sprayed out clouds of moisture. When he spoke, thousands of tiny, and sometimes not so tiny, droplets would burst from between his grey dentures to a distance of about 5 feet. His lifelong partner, Sunny Day, was the one with the halitosis. His striking distance was roughly the same as Rooney's. In the confines of the agent's office, I was caught in the crossfire of their respective afflictions and came near to turning the job in there and then. But by remaining alert to the twin threats, I was able to lean sideways and avoid the scattered showers coming in from Rooney, and when addressed by Day, to control my breathing so that I was not caught inhaling while he was speaking. Nevertheless, it was a great relief when the interview ended, and I was able to escape to the relatively healthy monoxide fumes of Shaftesbury Avenue. In retrospect, I realised that my somewhat hurried departure caused me to accept a salary lower than I might have been able to screw out of them had I been equipped with gas mask and protective clothing. But the agreement was made, and I set about doing the job cheerfully and well. It was not easy. One of the problems was their obsession with secrecy. Jimmy Rooney even balked at giving his right age when applying for a passport. He didn't mind his wife knowing, but there was a little woman in Rottingdean who apparently believed he was 10 years younger than he actually was, and he feared that if her illusion was shattered, he would no longer be welcome for the odd toasted tea cake. His partner, Sunny Day, didn't want anyone to know that he was sending maintenance payments to a woman in Cardiff who figured in his income tax return as a Welsh theatrical agent. They employed two accountants, but went to great pains to make sure that neither firm knew of the other's existence. Each accountant thought he was representing a double act, and so claimed expenses for two. I had to talk to each of these gentlemen and pretend I'd no knowledge of the other one. I didn't like the duplicity. Not because I had any strong feeling of allegiance to the Inland Revenue, please, but I didn't want to risk incriminating myself without standing to gain anything personally. Preparations for the trip nearly brought me to my knees. When I crawled into bed in the small hours, too tired to sleep, I fell to wondering how it had been possible for Barnum and Bailey to tour the world with their huge circus, how Anna Pavlova had actually been round it 5 times with ballet dancers and musicians, and that was before airplanes. I comforted myself with the thought that once we arrived, my twin burdens, Rooney and Day, would be passed onto the shoulders of D.K. Marples, the entrepreneur who had engaged them. Even though I had the foresight to book myself a seat well away from my employers, the flight to Sydney, with no overnight stop, was a tiring one. I didn't have much time to look at the magnificent view of the harbour as we flew into Sydney. I was busy trying to persuade the cabin crew to allow the stars to make their exit from the first class section for the benefit of the media I knew would be waiting. And so they were, about 200. An amazing turnout. It would have been an awful letdown if the big names from London had slinked out of the economy section. Having accomplished this bit of harmless deception, I saw them safely into the centre of the melee and then went off in the direction of the baggage hall. As I broke away, my arm was grabbed by a shortish man in a white cap about my own age. "What are they really like?" he asked me, sotto voce. I realised at once that he was a journalist looking for a controversial angle, and so, without a second's hesitation, I smiled. "Lovely people," I said, "hearts of gold." Considering my fatigue, jet lag, and the fact that I was at that moment in the ignominious role of baggage handler, I think I displayed a loyalty beyond the call of duty. Unfortunately, my glib answer was not enough to satisfy the man still hanging on to my elbow. He went on, "Is it true that they're on the skids back home and can't get work?" I shook my head and then my arm, but I couldn't escape his vice-like grip. "No," I said firmly, "they have turned down the Palladium to make this trip. They want to experience first-hand the wonderful Australian audiences they've heard so much about from their friend Max Bygraves and other all-time greats." Instinct told me I'd better not allow myself to be drawn into saying more. The man was grinning broadly already, and I guessed that the more I said, the more likely I was to be misquoted. "Lovely people," I repeated emphatically. He winked, and then suddenly his eyes opened wide as they focused on my flight bag, or rather the label attached to it. His smile was replaced by a look of astonishment. "Mr. J. Kingston Platt," he gasped. "Not the J. Kingston Platt?" I nodded warily. He let go my arm and shook my hand vigorously. "Charlie Maggs, Sydney Journal. This is a great pleasure. Welcome to this wonderful country." He took off his white cap with a flourish. He could see I was baffled. He chuckled. "You directed the tour of Honeymoon for Three, Winter Gardens, New Brighton, 62, right?" I nodded. "Well, well, well, Mr. J. Kingston Platt. May I call you Kingston?" "Jacko," I said. A loud, rather forced laugh came from the direction of the crowd as either Rooney or Day came out with one of their stock gags. Charlie Maggs turned. "I'd better get back and cover this, but I'm delighted to have made your acquaintance, and I shall hope to see something of you while you're here." And he was gone. I felt a touch smug. It's always nice to be recognised, particularly far from home. I was only sorry that Charlie had not seen a more representative example of my work. During the 10 days before the opening, a lot of media interest was generated by the management. Rooney and Day were kept busy making public appearances all over the city and on television. Their hotel room filled up with loot which they picked up gratis when they visited some of the big stores. Lunchtimes, they managed to visit veterans' hospitals, thus getting free meals. The evenings they spent alone in their hotel suite, which was paid for by D.K. Marples, at a much reduced rate, of course, on the understanding that the occupants would spend freely in the three great restaurants. But that was not the Rooney and Day style. Instead, they sent out for hamburgers and other fast food, which someone had to take through the crowded hotel lobby, into the lift and along to their suite in a suitcase carried horizontally. I don't have to tell you who that someone was. They were never great ones for rehearsing. They'd been doing the same routines for too long to want to change them or even bring them up to date. There was the sawing the woman in half sketch. A local actress was found who could speak the lines and could stay rigid lying on two chairs about 3 feet apart. The two comics didn't believe in exerting themselves in rehearsal, and so they tended to mutter their dialogue under their breath and sometimes didn't even bother to move about the stage, merely pointed to where they'd be at certain moments. Not easy for the musical director or the band. I remember the prop man and the box office manager asked me about the Conjurer sketch. At the time, I took this to be intelligent interest, but in retrospect, I realised that the subject worried them. It didn't bother D.K. Marples, however. He was professionally confident throughout, never more so than on the first night. He'd gathered together lots of local celebrities, sports stars and politicians. Also a handful of Australian millionaires who later ran into cash flow problems of the kind I have been faced with every day of my adult life. The curtain rose on three tap dancers doing a routine in front of a Bondi Beach backcloth. They wore lifeguard outfits in an effort to tap the reserves of goodwill which Sydneysiders have for those handsome young men who try to keep the local sharks undernourished. They were barely off the stage when Rooney and Day made their first entrance, fast and noisy. They were able to summon up amazing bursts of energy for men of their age. Sunny Day was on roller skates with an electric fan strapped to his behind as though propelled by it. At the same time, Jimmy Rooney started to recite a monologue about the gold rush. Thrown into the resulting crosstalk where gems like, "My dog doesn't eat meat. Why not? Because I don't give him any." And there were a few local references to the sleazier parts of Sydney. "A woman came up to me in the street and wanted to take me back to show me the place where she worked." These gags didn't work with the audience, and I saw the front rows grow gradually more tense. The two comics exchanged looks of alarm. They started to sweat. Although I was not emotionally involved in their success, I was hoping that once the show was launched, I should be free to enjoy a month or so of relative calm. I certainly never entertained the possibility of a disastrous flop and a speedy return to London. But this was a prospect I began to turn over in my mind. I watched the next two nondescript acts and waited anxiously for the big comic scene before the interval, sawing the woman in half. By the time Rooney came on in ill-fitting top hat and tails, followed by Day in drag as his assistant, the audience were chatting freely amongst themselves. When the handsaw was produced, they became restive. This was followed by a lot of shushing. Then there were cries of, "Who are you telling to shush?" And when Rooney waved the saw and shouted, "I feel like cutting up a side street," somebody shouted back that it was the best thing he could do. This got the biggest laugh of the evening. The sweating pair managed to get to the end of the sketch and the orchestra came in sharpish so that they could go into their corny arrangement of "Dear Old Pals." Down came the curtain. Better I should draw a veil over the second half. The only good thing I can say about it was that it didn't provoke so much hostility from the audience. That was because half of them had gone home. A few stayed in the bars, and only the friends of the management and a few ghouls stayed on to witness the death throes of the comic ambassadors from Britain. Backstage afterwards, I almost felt sorry for them as they staggered into the dressing room. Each sat down at his mirror and then, as one man, turned inwards as though the reflections were too much to bear. Eyes glazed, their out-of-date tuxedos damp and crumpled, they barely moved a muscle when I handed them each a stiff drink. They held the glasses in their hands and sat there panting and gazing into space. I didn't speak. There was silence for, I suppose, no longer than a minute. It was shattered by the arrival of the producer, D.K. Marples, D.K. as he liked to be called. He opened the door without knocking, slammed it behind him and stood with his back to it, panting like an angry bull. The boys gulped down their drinks. I moved to refill their glasses, but D.K. waved me aside. "Let me talk to them first," he bellowed. Jimmy Rooney made a gesture to me with his thumb, which I took to mean vanish. I did as I was told. I would have liked to have stayed to witness the post-mortem, so I did the next best thing. I closed the door behind me and walked noisily to the end of the corridor and then tiptoed back. D.K. started off by ridiculing the pair's secrecy at rehearsals. What was the point of it, he kept asking. If only they'd revealed the material they intended using, there might have been time to replace it. As it was, the audience was staggered to see the same sketches, word for word and gesture for gesture, that they had seen not once but many times before from Murphy and Hale. "Murphy and Hale?" I heard Jimmy gasped. "Who are they?" echoed Sonny. "Who are they? Who are Murphy and Hale, you may well ask? They are a local act 20 years younger than you two has-beens and twice as talented. They've been doing all that stuff for years." I heard the boys start to come alive. "Sonny," said Jimmy, "we've been robbed." I know," moaned Sonny. "Bloody thieves have stolen our act. We are the victims of barefaced piracy." "They think you are the pirates," boomed D.K. "On and on," he raved. The tap-dancing lifeguards walked past, listened for a moment or two, shrugged, and went on their way. D.K. cursed the day he'd booked Rooney and Day without seeing their act. He cursed Andy Fertel. He cursed the money he'd laid out on the production and on drinks for the press. Every time he paused to gulp in air, I heard Sonny try to get a word in, but he was immediately drowned out by more outraged ravings. Finally, after D.K. had to stop on account of a coughing fit, Sonny got his chance. "Tell you what," he said, "why don't we revive the sailor and the girl sketch?" He didn't get any further. D.K. erupted like a volcano. "The sailors and the girl? Are you trying to bring on a heart attack? Murphy and Hale actually stopped doing that old standby years ago. The girl got too old, and she was the daughter of the original. No, no, if that is your only suggestion, it just will not do. I give you notice. I am pulling the plugs. First time in my career. You finish Saturday. Saturday. You understand?" They understood all right. D.K. stormed out, almost knocking me over. I went in to inquire if there was anything I could do. It also crossed my mind that they might change the habits of a lifetime and go as far as to offer me a drink. But the miracle did not happen. They shooed me away, saying they'd things to discuss. That must have been the understatement of the year. The reviews the following morning were as bad as any I can remember. And believe me, I've seen some real beauties. For inducing suicidal depression, there could have been nothing in print like them since the casualty figures for World War I. For the rest of the week, we were well nigh empty at every performance. The culprits were practically thrown out of their hotel, the manager choosing the busy lobby as his venue for telling them loudly that guests who sent out for Big Macs to eat in their cut-rate rooms were not welcome. Turning the knife, he handed them a list of the items he expected to find after they'd left, 6 coat hangers, ashtrays, towels, etc. I got off lightly myself, and the management found me some real old-fashioned theatrical digs kept by a Mrs. Prentice, who'd emigrated from Bexhill. Poor old Mrs. Prentice, she lived in the past a lot and kept telling me about how she'd once been kissed by Danny LaRue. Rooney and Day moved into a small furnished flat, which must have been unpleasant for both of them. I'm referring to the halitosis and the saliva lake. Then, on the Friday of that dreadful week, I called to collect my salary, and they told me they couldn't pay me. They actually gave me notice. Not only that, but they were brazen enough to suggest I try and get another job as fast as I could. Well, that was bad enough, but what followed was a real blockbuster. Another job, they said, so that you can start saving up for your ticket home. That was my cue to explode. I don't think I have ever reacted so spontaneously or with such violence, except possibly when I've been alone watching Charles Aznavour on television. All the discomfort and suffering I had endured at the hands of these men, these mean, selfish, unappreciative, inconsiderate, hypocritical, unoriginal, smelly old, there's no other word for it, farts. All this combined with my outrage at being told to save up for my fare home, combined to produce an emotional charge well above the Richter rating achieved by DK a few days before. I went over in detail, at the top of my trained voice, all the humiliations and pain they had caused me, and then, when I saw they were suitably crushed, I told them, in the menacing whisper I had used in the 1947 tour of Dracula, that they would rue the day they ever tangled with J. Kingston Platt. I allowed a moment of silence to precede my exit. My chest swelled with pride. I knew I had spoken up for the exploited employees of tyrants down the ages. I fancied I could hear several million of them applaud as I closed the door behind me and made for the street. It was some time before I felt the depressing sense of anticlimax that always comes after a successful performance. I turned into an English-looking pub for a restorative. Once I'd sunk a large malt, I looked round and took in the theatrical posters and photographs on the walls, all stars of yesteryear. The peaty fluid from Speyside worked its curative magic, and I called for another. As I leaned forward to peer at a faded picture of the poignant young Jesse Matthews, I felt a tap on the shoulder. It was my friendly journalist acquaintance, Charlie Maggs. "Would you allow an old fan of yours to do the honours this time, Mr. Platt?" he asked. I was pleased to allow him, of course, and I was also pleased to talk to someone I'd met before, someone who had seen and remembered my production of Honeymoon for Three. Naturally, we talked about the Rooney and Day debacle. Though my funds were low, I bought him another drink. And when I recounted the conversation I'd just concluded with my ex-employers, he bought me yet another. He was almost as outraged as I was at the treatment I'd received. I remember him thumping the bar with his fist and calling them several Australian names which are new to me. I confess I don't remember a great deal else, but I must have recounted a number of my amazing experiences and dropped a few names because the following day he devoted his entire column to my career. He didn't mention that I'd been Rooney and Day's touring manager, merely described me as a doyen of show business who was sort of in Australia incognito. Possibly talent spotting, possibly setting up a movie. It was a marvellous PR job. Mrs. Prentice brought me the paper with my morning tea. She was most impressed. And when she answered the phone to a chat show host who wanted me on his programme that very afternoon, she was even more impressed. As the morning wore on, there were several calls from other newspapers, TV quiz shows and the like. I was suddenly a hot property. It was brief, but most enjoyable. In this business, one learns to enjoy as much as one can of whatever comes along. So when the limo came to take me to the TV show, I was quite euphoric, in spite of being pretty well penniless and with no prospects of earning my fare home. The show was aimed at housebound women, and most of the questions concerned my domestic life in England. I chatted convincingly about how I managed my large household staff and described the celebrities I entertained at my famous dinner parties. It all went very well, and I wondered if I'd get a fee for my efforts. Alas, the show's sponsors merely presented me with two complimentary tickets for a flower-arranging class and a year's supply of oven-cleaning fluid. As I walked off the set to make way for a pet kangaroo, who was, don't ask me why, wearing top hat and tails, I found Charlie Maggs waiting for me. "Quick," he said, "I want a private word. Can we go to your dressing room?" I started to thank him for the very favourable publicity. He wouldn't hear of it. muttered something about old time's sake and kept looking round to see if we were being followed. Once in the room, he took a final look outside and closed the door. "When I wrote my piece, I'd no idea it would prove so lucky for both of us," he said, "because overnight it's made it possible for you to speak out without appearing to be a mere disgruntled employee of Rooney and Day. You are now established as an authority, an expert in your own right." I started to thank him again, but he silenced me. "They're going to sue," he said. "Who are?" "Rooney and Day." "Sue who?" "Murphy and Hale, for stealing their act. When the evening editions come out, it'll be front-page news. But your old fan Charlie Maggs is one ahead of the game." I waited for him to explain. "Murphy and Hale are waiting for you now."
"Waiting for me?"
"Yes, certainly. You're a witness for the defence. Once the plaintiff's lawyers here are going into the box to talk about the Dooley brothers, they'll probably withdraw all charges."
"Now, Charlie, wait a minute," I said. "Dooley brothers, who are they?"
"You've heard of the Dooley brothers, surely?"
"I can't recall them."
"Not really brothers, cousins. Toured the old Orpheum circuit in the States. Worked for Ziegfeld."
I shook my head.
"Did the Sawing the Woman in Half sketch for 20 years, and the Sailors and the Girl, and the Electric Fan with the roller skates. Of course you remember them. Come on, they'll be wondering what's happened to us."
I asked him to explain in more detail. He said he'd tell me more in the car.
Well, by the time we got to my digs, I was convinced I had seen the Dooley brothers, not once, but several times. Murphy and Hale were sitting in the front room with tea and cakes. Mrs. Prentice was telling them how she had once briefly entertained the idea of becoming the first Mrs. Danny LaRue. Charlie sent her packing, firmly but politely. He introduced me. I told them everything he'd told me about the Dooley brothers and a few things that came to me on the spur of the moment. They were delighted. Murphy produced an excellent bottle of Australian champagne. Hale went downstairs to phone their lawyer. When he came back, he was beaming. He told us that their advisers knew the plaintiffs had no case and it would be laughed out of court. He'd phoned their lawyers and they'd straight away withdrawn from the case. It was a euphoric little scene. Before they left, Murphy and Hale invited me to join them for dinner that same evening at one of the great seafood restaurants of the world, with Charlie, of course. After we'd all signed Mrs. Prentice's celebrity tablecloth, we bade them au revoir, and Charlie shared out the last inch or two of champagne. He asked me if I was in a hurry to get back to London. I said, well, not particularly.
Nevertheless, he said.
What?
I think it might be wise not to stay around here too long. If you were ever asked any searching question about when you saw the Dooley brothers, it might be embarrassing. If you had to talk about them under oath, for instance.
I understand, I said. I'll go as soon as I can get my fare together.
That's not a problem, Jacko. Murphy and Hale are anxious to show their appreciation of what you've done. There's a boat sailing for Southampton tomorrow, and they'd be very happy to pay your fare.
But, Charlie, what about you? I said. You're the one who actually... He wouldn't let me go on.
Don't give it a thought, he said.
Anyway, I've got a lot of exclusive material out of this, and there's a lot more to come.
He was right there.
And had I been reading newspapers on the long voyage home, I would have read that Rooney and Day actually broke up their partnership. Never worked together again. And not very much separately, either. But I didn't even look at the newspapers when they were brought on board at the fascinating ports of call. I was too busy throwing myself into the life on board, ships, concerts, talks to the passengers about my amazing experiences. And also making friends with a lady from New Zealand, recently widowed. I shall always remember some of her fascinating Maori tattoos.